As you may know, there is a lockout going on here at SFU for QP Local 3338. Small but very powerful and passionate group of people. And along with my lovely co-host Frieda Werden, we have some of the people from QP 338 in studio with us. Let's go around and introduce ourselves.
My name is Lawrence Jones. I'm 16-year, I think, staff of the Simon Fraser Student Society. Most of that spent in the general office down in the Maggie Benson Center.
Thank you, Lawrence.
I'm Jan Gunn. I'm a member services coordinator for QP Local 3338. I used to be a student here, and I also used to be the internal relations officer for the Student Society.
Thank you, Jen.
And I'm Craig Pavlik. I am one of the out-on-campus volunteer and office coordinators, and I've been employed with the society since January of 2007. No, not 2007. That was when I started volunteering. 2010, last year.
Alrighty. And we also have Frieda Werden in the studio. Hello, Frieda, as usual.
Hi, Dan. All right, we're sharing mics, and people are going to hear the mics moving back and forth a bit. But I hope everybody will put up with that, because we've got very interesting people here. And hopefully some information that no one has really heard yet about what's happening with the Student Society, the labor dispute between the Student Society and their direct employees. So I'd like to start off, Lawrence, with you explaining what is QP and why is that the union you belong to?
QP is the acronym for the Canadian Union of Public Employees. Jan could correct me, but I think it's the largest public sector union in Canada. So there's a national. It's nice to be part of a union that has both national representation, mainly anchored back east, but at the same time it feels very personal and local. On that note, we are a local within both a larger unit or union up here, Local 3338, that encompasses hundreds, if not perhaps almost maybe 1,000 staff on Simon Fraser University, but. As public employees, it's been the union that we have belonged to for a long, long time. The early going was we were organized by a different union, but it made perfect sense to become part of a union that it contains many, many, many other workers who do the same type of work.
So it is a big union then. And QP, Jen, would you say that it's a very strong union?
Well, I think Barry said yesterday that we have 680,000 members across Canada. So I would say, as far as strong unions in Canada, it's probably one of the strongest, or amongst the strongest, however you decide to measure strength. I'm not personally a member of. I'm actually a member of COPE 378. I just work for the local. But I actually wish I was a member of QP. I find it to be encompassing and really democratic in a way that I think people are kind of fearful that their own unions aren't, and I don't really notice it in my union either, but I find QP to be not so top-heavy. We have a lot of independence at this local.
Who would you say the infected employees are in the SFS lockout, and what's their bargaining unit, and what jobs do they do?
We're actually members of bargaining unit, so of Local 3338, we're Unit 5. So this affects a number of areas of the Student Society. That includes the Women's Center, with the Women's Center Coordinator and Resource Assistant, out on campus, SFU's LGBTQ+ Center, which affects not only the Volunteer and Office Coordinator, but also the Web and Email Assistant. Down in the Maggie Benson Center, you'll find the Copy Center has been closed down, with the Copy Center Coordinator locked out. The General Office staff have been locked out, the two General Office Coordinators and the General Office Student Employees, front staff. The finance office has been affected, so that's two finance coordinators in that area. The resource office, which includes four employees, there's the policy and university relations coordinator. There is the departmental student union organizer, the research and campaigns coordinator, and the communications coordinator. And finally, last but not least, out in Surrey, there's the Surrey campus office as well, and so the Surrey campus coordinator has also been locked out. So that's a number of staff.
So 13, 14?
I think we're sitting at 13 right now. Some of our student staff had come to the end of their had graduated, and during this lockout have gone on to future endeavors.
So when did the contract expire? Because I understand you were working under a contract until a certain point.
Yeah, I'm really glad you asked this question, not so much the expiry, but because it'll segue into a note about contracts that I think is sorely misunderstood. The contract that we're working under, it's for folks who maybe don't know, in a union workplace, there's a contract that outlines all the rights, benefits, obligations, basic rules of play for both sides. These contracts are negotiated collectively, i.e. teams sit down year after year or at expiry dates and agree mutually to the new terms of the contract if they change at all. So the one we're currently working under expired August 31st, 2009. It's fairly typical that when a contract expires, nothing really changes. Everything remains in place. So this is a key component that though it's a contract that has expired, the only detail about it really is that a date has gone by. The contract, every word of the contract remains in place. It's a legal contract. It's a legal obligation on both sides that remains in power and in effect until any word of it or any clause of it is bargained away, and this is by mutual agreement. So we have every word, as does the employer, in the contract until it's given up by one of usually three ways. It's either things are traded back and forth, where by mutual agreement you say, we'd like this, we'll give you that, and you change. You can change contract language. Second, you can one side or other can make a really compelling argument where you convince the other to, in the context of bargaining in good faith, agree to relinquish something or make changes. And then the third way is to, when you really want something as an employer, for example, you can lock out your staff. And the severe financial pressure will force them to perhaps consider your point of view or force them to stay out long enough that other pressures come to bear. So I think that covers that.
Had you been negotiating already before the lockout?
Yeah, sure. We commenced a bargaining in 2009. There have been three boards in that time. So the mandate actually came from four boards ago, and then it was a third board that started bargaining, and then bargaining continued with the second board. The second board, and then this is the last most recent board. So it's been a lot of employer changeover in the bargaining process, and it's not atypical for bargaining to take a long time. We're also negotiating with the university, and that agreement expired in March 31st, 2010. So that in itself is not unusual. But the employer changing over, that's the unusual part. And I would say the main reason that this has taken as long as it has is because when the parties exchanged proposals way back, the employer put forward a proposal that changed. I mean, they were rewriting the collective agreement. It was line-by-line changes. It was small things. It was a huge package, and it took a long, long time to get through those language changes. And, I mean, at the end, hardly anything was changed anyways, and it's the normal practice that you leave monetary items to the end. So when this board came into power in May, that's when we were starting to get down to the nitty-gritty of wages and monetary issues.
So what is the union asking for, and are you taking the society's ability or inability to pay at this time into account?
Well, the what we're asking for it changes over time slightly, in that we, like Jan just mentioned, we came in with a package that had some proposals from housekeeping, i.e. small word changes, to larger changes. And obviously through the bargaining process, that evolves. We are currently seeking really the status quo in an effort to reach an agreement and to bargain in good faith and to recognize that at least part of the problems facing the society have a lot of people feeling very strongly. In recognition of that, we are currently seeking status quo in almost every single area, if not actually offering to freeze certain agreements or certain entitlements that we have. So I'll just summarize, and maybe Jan or Craig might pop in with some things that I've missed, but we currently are seeking no increase in wages. We have in our agreement what's called a cost of living adjustment, or COLA. It's quite common among QP unions. I think there's maybe 40 to 60% of QP locals have this cost of living adjustment. It's something that every worker on the planet should have so that your wages aren't losing pace with inflation. We have offered to freeze that. In other words, we want the language to remain in the collective agreement because there are some financial changes coming down the road for the student society that we can get into later. But we are willing to have that not apply to our wages for the term of the agreement. We're not seeking additional staff. We came into this round of bargaining hoping to seek protection for a couple of new staff in areas that we recognize as desperately in need of stable support, and that's in the Women's Center and out on campus. So from that initial position, we are basically holding the line to what we have in recognition, like I said, that that time will I think bring some improvements for the society, but for currently we're willing to bargain in good faith.
What precipitated the lockout? Did you have any advance warning?
Well, I think that we had a feeling. I don't feel like it came as a big surprise, but I may be more pessimistic than the average person, and I saw a bunch of business students get elected, and lo and behold, we were locked out. But no, we were a little surprised because before we really got started on the money issues, they invited us to mediation. And we were sort of like, we haven't even started talking about this yet, and you want to mediate? So I think that set off a bunch of alarm bells.
Yeah, if I could add slightly, and I know Craig's got something to add as well, that we had been bargaining. I think we've alluded to this earlier. It's a bulky process. That both committees are large, 4 to 5 members on each side, with and several members with very busy schedules. So you can imagine that between other bookings for other everyone, many of our key people do other work as well. So the time that it takes can drag on just administratively. So it took a long time, and we had never felt that from our side that things had actually broken down. In other words, there had never been a meeting where, you know, glasses were smashed and people walked away cursing and swearing. It was nothing even close to that. It was it purely just felt like the bulkiness of working through the process, and to suddenly find ourselves called down to the Labor Relations Board, which is where the mediation that Jan referred to happens in downtown Vancouver on the 6th floor of this very suit and tie building. It felt really out of the blue, and we wondered about being part of a greater plan.
And as far as getting that forewarning, I know it was early July we got an email saying that we had to come into a meeting where we were going to see an offer from the board. And knowing that we came into this meeting not expecting anything great, but seeing the proposal that they had come forward with at that point, and essentially at that time being given the ultimatum to take this proposal or be locked out, it was a little bit of a shock, to be honest. I mean, nobody expects or wants to be locked out, and job action's not great. But seeing that proposal that they come forward with, there's no way we could have signed on to it in good faith at all. I would say one thing I've heard a lot of, especially closer to the beginning of this lockout, was people saying that this wasn't bullying. It wasn't bullying. We actually had, in the first couple weeks of the lockout, an ad in The Peak where some of our staff were wearing no bullying t-shirts. And one of the critiques was, oh, it's not bullying, it's taking control of the society. And, you know, the board of directors have always had control. The staff are here to support them. And the fact that they've locked us out and denied wages and denied services to students in an effort to not only financially bully the staff into an agreement, but bully them into an agreement that is not fair to them or to the students that they serve, it's bullying.
Jan, just with regards to this sudden change in the student society with respect to the employees, you mentioned just kind of in passing that when you saw business students elected, you wondered if something might happen. I'm wondering, I mean, is this something that is very, I mean, does it represent a taught system in the business schools or a general business philosophy with respect to wages that you're seeing operating here?
Well, I mean, I can't speak to what business students learn in business school, but I can tell you it feels very corporate. It feels very neoliberal. I mean, it's it's unusual for a student society to have directors who aren't sort of, I mean, for lack of a better term, sort of more progressive and left-leaning. That in itself is unusual. The feeling was different right away. In the society's own policy, the board members, in order to address the imbalance in perceived power between students negotiating collective agreement and union negotiating collective agreement, the directors must have a management consultant on their side, and they always have in the past, and the process has gone very smoothly. But these guys went above and beyond a management consultant, and they hired a shark lawyer from Harrison Company. And lawyers aren't the best negotiators, but they went above and beyond just management consultant, and they got themselves sort of a highly paid corporate downtown lawyer. So, yeah, it feels very like a big philosophical shift from our perspective.
Since the lockout has started, have you guys gone back to the bargaining table at all?
No, because this isn't collective bargaining what they're doing right now. We have been invited into negotiation sessions. The bargaining committees have met, but I wouldn't call that collective bargaining, not when, we're under the gun. That's not collective bargaining. That's a terrible, mean-spirited thing to do to someone.
It's apparently quite unprecedented to put in place a process that looks like collective bargaining, but really, when you're the parameters are very restricted, it's like a shotgun wedding, in a lot of ways. And so that you can call those proposals perhaps when you're holding a gun to someone's head, but it does, and it's not maybe quite fair to paint it that way exactly, but it is. We're in a you're bargaining in a or talking or discussing things in a very pressure-ridden situation.
By that pressure and the gun to your head, you said or kind of took that back. I mean, you mean the fact that none of the workers has any wages now?
Yeah, exactly. So it's everything that's considered, even if it's a single line or a single offer or suggestion, always is in the context of, if we say yes, we resume our wages. And that's not what bargaining should be. Bargaining in the best circumstances should be about solid analysis, solid ideas, and broad consultation, and that's been sorely, sorely lacking in all of this. And bargaining where many members of the unit feel intense and increasing financial pressure, it obscures, it removes the offer itself from a pure context of this has value or this doesn't, to in any broader context, to just simply its financial value. So we can say yes to this obscure and hurtful and harmful clause or something because it'll relieve my financial pain, and that's not a fair, it's not a productive way to produce a better agreement for the society, for the staff, or ultimately for the student members.
So are there a lot of different things that have been laid on the table during this coercive bargaining process? You're nodding, Jen.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a little shocking to see how they change their position on a regular basis. I mean, ultimately, they want the same thing. Jeff McCann has said, basically, we just want to pay you less for doing the same work, and that's where they're coming from. But to see the weird ways they're trying to achieve that, like, you know, we give them a what I consider to be an amazing financial analysis, a five-year plan, well-researched, well-detailed. You know, we put that on the table, and Jeff and company come back with, well, we want to remove the financial coordinators from the bargaining unit and exclude them as management. So, like, things that were never, ever part of the bargaining package, there were never proposals, have shown up, like these bizarre ideas for how we're going to pay you less for doing the same work.
Okay, so the financial coordinators were locked out as members of the bargaining unit. So if they remove them from the bargaining unit, do they have to pay them all their back wages?
I don't know. I mean, if we would ever, I mean, I don't think we would ever agree to something like that, and I'm pretty sure our financial coordinators would be opposed to it too. But no, when the lockout ends and workers go back to work, no, they're not entitled to any back wages. That's not how it works. They're done with their salaries for that period. So that's a cost savings to the employer. They have saved, and I think Lawrence can tell you how much they've saved, actually, since the lockout started.
I meant to have that number. It's obviously changing weekly. It's about 15. At the beginning, it was almost $17,000 a week that was being saved. So I think we're in the neighborhood of, you know, roughly 10 times 15, so $150,000 to $60,000.
Was there ever a counteroffer made by the union before the lockout started, like in the bargaining process?
Yes, there were. There's been a certain back and forth throughout the process going back to mediation, which was a really bulky process. We have to say, just since we're discussing this entire issue, mediation is. You're in separate rooms where you depend entirely on the skill of the individual going back and forth. So you need their skill both in encapsulating points of view, imagining spots where the other side might be willing to move. But it's a little bit like the telephone game where we've heard subsequently that in some of our mediation that what we were expressing quite clearly was not getting to the other side in anything like that form. So back to your question, Dan, about counters. We have, again, the bulkiness of the process and the difficulty this time, and I think the difficulty in doing counters under the threat or with a lockout over your head is that it's produced counters that are more presented as chunks. So there have been a couple of chunks that have gone back and forth. And what I mean by that is that there's been kind of a set written offer that maybe they've given us, and then we take it, read it, and present a kind of chunk back rather than exploring. If we were able to remove this threat of take off the pressure of lockout and explore these points in general one by one and actually collectively bargain around them, it would be much easier. So we are poised to and able to present and we're going to work on a counter if we get the cooperation of the board to join us.
The SFSS said that they put an offer on the table and that it included no reduction in pay and so forth. And want to know, you know, like, what was the content of that offer? I know it was put up for a vote. Then how was it perceived and why was it rejected?
Well, that proposal that we saw, it was just about a week and a half ago, included quite a few different items. Yes, the current staff would have been grandfathered at their current wages. That includes the permanent staff and the student employees. And by student employees, I mean student employee in the singular. We were down to one student employee. Any new staff coming in would have been at drastically reduced wages. Student employees at $13 an hour, which is 40% less than the current student employee wage. Now that's less than an SFU pays their employees, whether it be at the library or the bookstore. They get about, I think, $16.10 an hour plus 9% in lieu of benefits. So almost $17.50, $18 an hour or so. This is for students who are going to school, paying tuition, buying books for the classes. Many of them aren't privileged enough to live at home. They have rent to pay. They have bills, food. We live in Vancouver. It's not cheap to live here. So that $18-ish dollars an hour was great. But the student society should be supporting their students at a wage that can actually support them through their time at school, and not adding undue stress where they're looking for extra positions elsewhere. When the mandate of the society is to provide services and opportunities to students, it should not be at these drastically reduced wages. And we weren't able to sign on to that, because at the end of this lockout, we would actually need to hire another 4 or 5 new student employees, and they would immediately be at that lower $13 an hour, and we couldn't sign on to that. Part of the other thing is that those reduced wages would never at any point have increases or enough of an increase to actually ever make it up to the current wages of the staff. So essentially we're selling out all the new people that would be coming in who would never be able to actually meet our same wage scale and saying that they're not worth what the current staff are worth. And that's not fair to them either.
So currently this disagreement is about the wages of four or five people.
Part of it is incoming students. Employees would be part of that, but also permanent staff. We've seen, if you look at the past number of years, staff in the resource office, the turnover is quite high. And so bringing them in at lower wages would not be encouraging them to stick around that much longer.
Yeah, actually, this is an area where I have a huge problem, and I don't think the Student Society has done a proper and thorough analysis, and it makes me disbelieve the genuineness of this offer. If you look historically at the resource office, these are the people that I think what everyone does is important and useful and good for the society, but the resource office in particular are the two people that work most closely towards the fundamental goals of the Student Society. So these are people that do campaigns, they do communications, it's government relations, it's all that kind of work. Historically, in the 10 years that I have been here, there have been 10 people in that office. So this is really high turnover. You can't, Jeff McCann's statement is that it's what the market can bear. This is his philosophy. The market clearly can't bear the wage that they're currently making. History tells us that those are the first places you're going to find vacancies. The resource office, those people are going to leave. The new hires are going to come in at the much lower rate of pay. You can't keep them at their current rate of pay. How are you going to keep them at the lower rate of pay? And it's not, it's not a fly-by-night operation. You need people in there who have been around the Student Society, who understand its goals, who have a handle on the work that it does. You can't have that high of turnover and expect quality work. So it just tells me that it's not well thought through, that it's philosophically based, that it's nobody has taken a look at the reality of the situation, because the reality of the situation is we know without question that that office is going to have vacancies and they're not going to be able to fill those positions with quality staff people that will stick around for any length of time at a very subpar wage.
So what were some of the differences between the sides over the process by which the offer was created, and what are some of the parameters that are used to perhaps judge an offer?
Well, it's an interesting process, because I think to a certain degree every individual brings their own background, philosophy, and obviously under lockout their own financial stress plays a role. In other words, it's like when you're full, that second hamburger looks really boring, but when you're starving, it looks like the greatest food you've ever seen. So there's to a certain degree, there's that analogy can apply. But it's a fascinating process to watch how an offer, for example, and I'm sure this happens on the board side, is, okay, let me take that back. I'm not so sure that how fully democratic and how much time on the board side is devoted to analyzing our offers. But on our side, it's a broad range of things. People bring their history, people bring their passions, people bring arguments that maybe hadn't been previously thought of. And in the end, there's a democratic process based on all of that, a lot of discussion and thought. And also, we're talking to students, dozens and dozens of students every day, and we're getting a broad range of opinion, a lot of thoughts that are very supportive, a lot of people with questioning minds. I mean, we're at a university after all, so a lot of people want information. They're hungry for information, and it's been really difficult to get it out to them. But we find that once we're able to talk at any length, that we're able to absorb opinions from the student body that we then obviously take into any of our decisions. So our analysis and breakdown of any offer is not just about us. I mean, we're here, the bulk of staff work with students day in and day out and over the years, and we feel like the Student Society is is ours as much as anyone's, and that's we try and bring those opinions into all of what we decide.
So we're talking about we're talking about wages here, and about what parameters can be brought to bear to judge the offer. And you gave some examples of that these wages that they were offering were not as high as wages in other parts of the university, for instance, for comparable work. And also then, Jen, you mentioned that people are not staying in those jobs, which might suggest that they are not sufficiently well paid. But the Student Society, for example, has published that the coordinator of the Women's Center at University of Victoria is making much considerably less than the coordinator of the Women's Center here. And there are other, and of course a lot of people are working non-union at jobs. And I have to say that, you know, quite often this is something the public says, oh, people in unions are making a lot more money than I am, therefore, if I can work for this, they're making too much money. So you want to address that a bit?
Well, I mean, I guess it comes down to your philosophy. The Student Society has, to date, always had a philosophy that we should, and I say we as a former director, that we should compensate people fairly for the work that they perform. I know that I have signed off on collective agreements that I was proud to sign off on, and it wasn't, you know, we weren't sitting at the table saying, how can we maximize the amount of money that we don't have to spend on these wages? I mean, we went into bargaining knowing that we had an understanding and a belief that people deserve to be fairly compensated. So if we're, I mean, that's the position that we're coming from, and I don't think that that is wrong. And I think that the union philosophy generally, for all those people in the private sector that don't have unions, that what we wish for one, we wish for all. And I wish that everyone could make union wages, and I wish that everyone could have the protections of the collective agreement. But that isn't the case. And to all those people who aren't making good wages, I encourage you to organize. I can point you in the direction of QP organizers that will help you get your place of work unionized. So that's how I would address that.
So if the process is now at a standstill, who or what can move it from the current situation?
Students. If there's one thing that I know the staff, and we heard it at the rally yesterday, and I totally agree with it, I've been saying that since the beginning of this lockout, if there's one thing that the staff and the students and the board of directors even can agree on, is that the Student Society, the SFSS, is yours, is the students. The students are paying their activity fees, the students are supposed to be getting their services. This society belongs to them, these services are for them. We are here to serve them, but they're not getting those services. They are not being represented properly or fairly. There was no consultation of students before this lockout happened. It just came out of nowhere, and so we're telling students, theirs is the voice that needs to be heard. If we as staff could turn and say, okay, time for the lockout to end, trust me, the lockout would be over 10 weeks ago when this started. It's the students that have the power. The students elected this board of directors, and the board of directors, in a proper democracy, should be listening to their electorate. The board of directors have office hours. Their office is open to them. What should be common knowledge, I'm not sure if it is that all board of director meetings and all committees of the society are open to all undergrad students. So all undergrads are able to sit in on their meetings and have their voices heard. I encourage students to sit in and talk with the directors. And that I just said to undergrad students, but all students, whether they're grad students or staff or faculty, we're here for the whole community. A lot of the services that we provide are not just for undergrad students. And so when the board of directors, especially at the beginning of this lockout, targeted their information specifically at undergrads, they were neglecting a huge portion of people that they are here to serve. The graduate students pay into certain services of the society as well, like out on campus, the Women's Center, the Legal Aid Clinic, which was slashed to a quarter of its size back in the spring, and they weren't consulted on any of this either. So I encourage the graduate students, as well as the undergrads, this entire SFU community, to get involved, email the board of directors, ask us questions, talk to them in person. It's the board of directors that need to hear from the students and from the people that they serve what the people want. And I don't think the people want their staff outside, locked out, unable to serve them. They don't want their services shut down. Because we've been here for years. We've built up. We can't neglect the work that's been done over the past many, many years to create this really awesome society for SFU. We're here, we do so many great things on a year-to-year basis. That's actually one of the wonderful things I loved about SFU when I first started coming here, is that there is a sense of community, and the student society provides that. But to see them rip that out from under people's feet has just been disheartening, to say the least.
On that consultation note, there's an important piece to remember here, is that we are a student society. So the key word being society. I think it in a lot of people's mindsets, it feels like this is government. This is not government. Government, during an election, for a government, the winning party, the first past the post, gets its mandate for its term. So whether it's 3-4 years, it gets its mandate at an election time, and that mandate allows them to enact decisions that impact their constituents and beyond. We're a society, and we can't raise fees that we charge society a quarter cent without going back to the membership. Now, the inverse of that would imply that you can't slash services that are being offered, or radically change that even, without being in touch with your membership. So you need to always be in touch, constantly be reminding yourself that you're working for the student society in its length and breadth. One of the mechanisms that you do that, like as Craig was saying, is, and there are at least three, there's the board of directors itself, the 16 members who are ostensibly in touch with different constituent groups. There's a body called Forum that maybe a lot of people haven't heard of. It's made up of representatives from each departmental student union. This as well is a direct way of being in touch with a finger on the pulse of what the diverse range of opinions are across academic departments over campus. And then there's the student body at large. Forum does have an ability to form advisory bodies, for example. They could strike advisory committees, and even just as it exists, it's a body where opinions can be tested and heard from. And I don't know that it's been properly resourced at all, but we're a society is one of the key pieces that's missing here.
I know Craig had alluded there to talking about the services, and I was hoping you guys could elaborate on how the services delivered to students have been affected, and specifically what is happening with the SFSS business in the absence of the workers.
Yeah, I can touch on that a little bit. A number of the services are essentially gone. For example, the handbook that comes out at the beginning of the semester is not currently available. It would have been designed by staff, provided during the first week before classes, would be here. The board has, I believe, designed their own. They have said so. It's supposed to be around soon. We will see. One of the many other services is the copy center. The copy center is essentially shut down. It's not available for students to use, although the board is able to use it for their personal internal purposes, including their posters that they've been putting up to support the lockout, using student fees to pay for that. Other areas that have been affected out on campus has essentially been shut down. I believe I mentioned it during an interview I had on here back during the first week of the lockout, but the board of directors negligently broke the door. So volunteers who even wanted to cross a picket line and provide the space, the lounge out on campus, couldn't do so. So the door has been fixed. Volunteers who choose to cross the picket line to provide a space, but without services, in the lounge out on campus could do so. To date, none of them have. The Women's Center. The Women's Center has two areas. Includes their resource library and office space, where students can actually access services from the staff. So similar to out on campus, the Women's Center offers a library, support services, referrals, volunteer training opportunities. And like out on campus, these opportunities are all shut down right now. As always, the Women's Center lounge is open 24/7, but is not maintained. It is not staffed by anybody.
It's not even cleaned.
It's not even being cleaned. I don't know when the last time the garbage was changed in there. And it is also, again, behind a picket line. So students are being reminded that it is behind a picket line, and traditionally crossing that is a show of non-solidarity, although students have different reasons for that, why they may be crossing it. Services such as the resource office, again, as I mentioned before, have been shut down. So if you're sitting on a committee of the student society, if you're a club or a DSU, DSU being departmental student unions, you can't access the training for your clubs that you normally would, or the support for whether it's your communications work, your advertising, etc. If you're at Surrey campus, you are essentially SOL. They are not running the Surrey campus office at all. So if you're a club or department of student union, need to do a room booking in Surrey, any of that, you are essentially out of luck because that's shut down. The general office here at the Maggie Benson Center is being run Monday through Thursday, so limited hours from 10 to 4 on 4 days a week in lieu of the 5 days that it's normally opened. The general office is being run by two board members who are essentially, although management in a way are scabbing their own society workers, they're able to do some club and DSU funding, room bookings, health permits, etc. It's been in limited amounts and limited training for them for what they're able to do. And I believe our impression has been that the workload seems to have been pretty light for them. I believe that's because a lot of students are respecting the picket line and not crossing that picket line. One thing we've definitely seen is students trying to access club days, which is happening right now, actually. And so people have been asking us, what's the most effective way to address this issue? And there's essentially two options. You can not cross the picket line, and unfortunately then not get your club days. And so deny them services, showing solidarity with the staff. The other option is to cross that picket line and, you know, access the services, because we understand clubs and DSUs need that exposure during club days. They need to continue to function. And when in doing so, we ask them to raise a little bit of hell while they're doing it, go in there and not be happy about it. Because I know a lot of students are not comfortable crossing the picket line, but feel that they have no other option. So we've talked earlier about things that they can do. They can, you know, express their opinions. That's another one that's actually been an option, is alternative club days, where we set it up outside in Fountain Square right next to your regular club days. There's a lot of groups in DSUs and clubs, constituency groups that are all out there right now in solidarity with the staff, not crossing their picket lines, and still getting their message out. And it's just to show that you don't need to cross the picket line, you don't need to show non-solidarity to still be effective. But there are options out there for our students. Mm-hmm. So that's a number of the different services that have been affected. Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering, how has the union supported you guys during the lockout? And like, what are the members living on? Are some of them working other jobs? And how do you all hang on to your jobs during the lockout?
This is where being part of a union does, the support of the union does come in enormously. There are different levels of strike pay that, while much, much smaller than our actual wage, does mean that you don't go from 60 to zero overnight, which would be really untenable. I don't think it would be fair to share numbers exactly, but there is some support there that allows us to carry on, because the key pressure, obviously, in a lockout is financial. That's the one single weapon that a lockout provides. The support we have is there's a communications director for QP, whose job is to tweet, design, monitor media, come up with suggestions. We've been working with that person, who themselves has a team at QP who can design things, ideally. There's also practical support. The rally yesterday was really quite encouraging, when you think that the 12 or 13 of us have the eye of the national executive of QP. So at some level across this country, the 13 of us have a lot of bodies, a lot of voices, a lot of awareness, and each of those hundreds, I don't know, we didn't do a count yesterday, but I would say 300-400 people at least, and each of those, you know, the so on thing, they're all connected, and that support comes back to us in emails and conversations, and even just the knowledge that it's there. So that being part of a larger body with passionate, intelligent, caring people, very strong.
Following up on that, there are other QP bargaining units on campus, including, I think, another unit that are actually employees of the Student Society, correct? So how does your standing up to the lockout affect or relate to those employees?
Sure, yeah. The Student Society also has a another group of employees. They're the food and bev service employees, so they work in the pub and the ladle and Higher Grounds Cat Bar and doing catering. It's a different collective agreement. That's a historical anomaly. We're not sure why they're completely separate, but they have always been treated as separate entities of the Student Society. So on the one side, there's the food services, and the other side, we call it the advocacy side. I'm not sure if it has a proper name. But yeah, there it's a different collective agreement, even though it's the same employer, and so they're not affected by the lockout because they're not in a... We haven't actually commenced bargaining. The collective agreement did expire, but neither party has given notice to commence bargaining. I mean, I don't... I'm not sure we could either side wants to take on an additional round of bargaining at this point. So yeah, there's been a lot of solidarity and support from the food and bev members towards the advocacy side, and when it's food and bev's turn to bargain, I'm sure there'll be an equal amount of support from the advocacy side towards food and bev staff.
How have the two sides conducted your Hearts and Minds campaigns?
Could you expand a bit, Dan?
I think.
Or Frida?
Yeah. So, I'm noticing, for example, that the Student Society has been using Twitter and posters, and your side has been feeding hamburgers, and want to know how... I mean, each of you is trying to sway the student opinion with respect to this. So how does it look to you?
It looks to us like, we actually don't have to sway necessarily. I think we really just have to get our message out a little bit. And we feel really strongly, and this has been the case from day one, that when people are able to hear all the arguments, there's a logic there. There's a logic. There's an analysis. That's based on broad research, and a historical pattern in a union workplace. I think it's really interesting that one of the that the club on campus that has been was first most curious about this and has now come to a conclusion in support of us is the Skeptic Club, because they're by nature, they have a long history of carefully examining every issue that's presented to them, and they have, some of their members have examined this very, very, very closely. They took time to inform themselves, they went right to the source and asked each side, and you'll see them at alternative club days because they have the information, and the issues have left them with one conclusion, and that is that what's happening feels like a kind of labor violence. It feels wrong on so many fronts, and they've come to the conclusion they have. So we don't feel like we have to do too much more than just put out the information to anyone who comes to ask us.
So along that note, what has this experience taught you about labor relations, and if you were going through this process again, would you think you would do anything differently?
Yeah, we have learned an enormous amount. I think communications is key, and identifying the areas where you need to get your information and message out, and getting it out quickly and clearly is certainly key. I hadn't anticipated the amount of spin, to put it kindly, up to massive spin, to put it less kindly, up to complete deception, to put it accurately, on some of the points that are coming out. And I could say this to any board member, and it has felt really challenging to be having what's in part at least an ideological battle when the sands are shifting so enormously on the other side. There don't seem to be it's a George Bush, Dick Cheney kind of weapons of mass destruction kind of rationale on some of the issues are coming out, and that makes it really difficult to have any kind of battle that's close to a fair fight. We don't want to fight in the first place, but when there doesn't seem to be any need for accuracy. I mean, for example, recent posters, we offered job security. In fact, we have job security now. Back to that contract language I was referring to, we have job security now. What's being offered is a stay of execution of 2 years. And then the end to job security. So that, I mean, that's just the simple, that's just out there on paper. That's a fact. The fact that the so-called, and many people won't even know what this is necessarily, but the reallocation of the Space Expansion Fund, we came up with a solution that Jan was talking about earlier to correct for a cash flow problem. We solved that problem during not bargaining, but mutual information sessions, board side, staff side, and then to come. I arrived at Surrey 2 weeks ago to find that this offer to replenish the society's funds through the reallocation of some student fees was rejected by us when every member embraced it. In fact, we designed and presented it and explored it to its fullest extent. It is just mind blowing and really, really challenging.
And we're also seeing a difference in the posters or whatever, where the student society says the wage offer was $23 an hour, and you're saying $13 an hour.
The $23 an hour wage from their last offer was for new hires of permanent staff, and the $13 wage that they didn't tell you about was what they offered new student staff. So that's just the difference. There's always been a permanent wage and a student staff wage, and student staff and term employees.
What's the current permanent
wage? Sure, the current permanent starting wage is $3.40 an hour, and I invite the Student Society most heartily to engage in a proper job evaluation process if they honestly and genuinely believe that their staff are overpaid, because I promise you that they will find that it isn't the case. I think all you have to do is look around campus and look to other CUPE members who work for SFU. There's a professional job evaluation process in place for SFU employees. It's on a job scale. There's a weighted job questionnaire. It assigns a points value to each individual task. I've looked very thoroughly over job descriptions at for SFU employees. I've looked over job descriptions for Student Society employees, and I remain convinced that many of the jobs of the Student Society wouldn't even be CUPE jobs at SFU. They would be excluded in the APSA organization, Association of Professional and Administrative Employees. So if the Student Society had a genuine desire to evaluate staff positions, then they should undertake a professional process to do that and not guess, because that's what they've done here. And it's really, really disrespectful.